The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hello everyone and welcome to A Cast of Kings, an unofficial podcast about the HBO original series Game of Thrones. My name is David Chen, and I've never read any of the books in George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and I've read every book in George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
And welcome back to A Cast of Kings. If you're just tuning into this show for the first time, you should know that you can find all of our episodes at GameofThronesPodcast.com. You can also email us and let us know what you thought of this week's episode of the podcast and of the show at acastofkings@gmail.com. We also spoil everything through this week's episode of Game of Thrones, but we don't do anything, we don't spoil anything from future week's episodes, and that includes anything found in the Next Time on Game of Thrones preview that HBO frequently airs. So for this week's episode of the podcast, we will be talking about everything through Season 3, Episode 2, Dark Wings, Dark Words. That's Dark Wings, Dark Words. We'll be spoiling everything through this week's episode. Okay, but before we get to this week's episode, Joanna Robinson, sometimes in the fog of war, judgment can be clouded and a grasp of basic fundamental facts about the Game of Thrones universe can be lost. And, you know, this is an inevitability and we regret it when it happens, but mistakes are occasionally made on this podcast.
Mostly by Dave, never by me.
Yeah. So anyway, there's a couple of things that people wanted to correct us on last week. I'm sure more than a couple, but the two big ones were that, first of all, the scene in last week's episode of Game of Thrones when Davos has to guess, you know, which one of his rescuers, which king his rescuers are sort of serving. That did in fact appear in the books. Joanna, I don't know how you could
I should make mention of the fact that I went back and checked and it's like one, honestly, it's one paragraph. Well, it's not like it's, I missed it. I apologize. But some people emailed and they're like, it was the most pivotal moment of the entire book. And I was like, it's not. It's a paragraph. I'm sorry I missed it.
We expect your knowledge to be encyclopedic and inerrant. So I don't know, you know. There's no excuse is what I'm saying. So.
Oh, absolutely no excuse.
Yeah,
fear smackings and whackings.
That's right. And the second thing is that somehow – so one of two things is true. Either both Joanna and myself misremembered the opening sequence of Game of Thrones for the season premiere, or we both got an earlier version of the episode – or we both saw an earlier version that didn't show Winterfell smoking.
No, I went back and watched my version and it was definitely there. So
it was smoking no or –
It was smoking, yeah.
Okay, so we were both wrong about that. I don't know how we missed out on such a crucial modification to the opening credits, but...
Especially since we were both looking for
it. Yeah, we were both looking for it, and I guess sometimes...
We still missed it.
You know, so. You know, that's... Well, that's why we have our... You know, actually, Joanna, I'm going to spin this as a test for our listeners, just to see if they're paying attention. And, you know, guys, I have a feeling we're going to... You're going to sprinkle in a few more test questions throughout the course of this episode. You know, that if we make any mistakes, it's just really a way of seeing if you guys are still listening. So, yeah, there we go. Anyway, apologies for the errors. We always try to avoid them, and we really appreciate it when you guys correct us. We don't want to be propagating false information out there. So,
I will say, not since like the Hodor penis gate of last season have I received so many messages and tweets about and screen caps of things, and they're like, there's smoke, don't you see it? I see it now, man. I see it now.
There you go. There
can't
you
go. Unsee it. So there you go.
All right, well, let's move on into this week's episode. So just to give you guys a sense of what we're going to be doing today, we're going to be talking about this week's episode, and then we're going to be thanking some of the sponsors for this week's episode of the podcast, and then delving into your emails. We got a ton of emails, ton of comments at slashfilm.com. So looking forward to talking about some of those. So let's get into the show, Joanna. Let's go storyline by storyline and then talk about general impressions of this episode. So this episode begins with Bran, and he's running, so we know that it's a dream.
Unless people are like, oh my God, he's cured.
No. I don't think they thought that. And then he sees his brothers appear out of nowhere, even more sign that it's a dream. And sees the three-eyed crow, this motif that has come back to the show again and again. So he sees this boy in his dream. What's the name of the boy we find out later on in the episode?
Jojen Reed.
Jojen Reed. He sees Jojen Reed, who makes some really sort of creepy – he's a kind of a creepy presence. I believe he talks during this opening scene, right?
Yes, yeah. And he says, you can't shoot the crow, you're the crow, is what he says,
yeah.
Essentially.
So then later on in the episode, right, we have Bran still on the run, still kind of having escaped Winterfell barely with Asha, and they kind of Jojen Reed and his sister get the drop on them, right?
Yes.
So before we progress any further, I guess, what is going on here, Joanna? I just, like, who is this guy? You know, there's probably nothing you can tell me at this point, but...
No, there are things. No, there's definitely things I can tell you. What I can tell you is that Jojen and Mira actually show up in book two. They were supposed to be there for most of last season. And so they were these two characters that a bunch of book lovers were like, where are Jojen and Mira Reed? They were supposed to be with Bran and Rickon, like, you know, in Winterfell when it was still intact.
Oh, interesting.
And, you know, the writers in their infinite wisdom decided to push them back until this season, which is – it worked out fine. But Jojen Reed has these prophetic dreams. They're called green dreams. And they gave that – like the integral one they gave to Bran instead last season, and it worked fine. Bran has these wolf dreams where he's a wolf all the time. And so they sort of given Bran some more of Jojen's characteristics to sort of blend it all together. But basically these two kids are – they're of House Reed, and they are – House Reed is, you know, one of the – they're bannermen to the Starks. They're loyal to the Starks. And so as they reveal later in the episode, Jojen's father knew Ned Stark, and basically Jojen had these dreams about Bran, and so he came to find him is the premise of the TV show, is that Jojen came – they came to find them because he had dreams about Bran because Bran is important. So
yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does. That actually does help a lot. I will say that based on what you're saying, it does seem to make sense to push the introduction of these characters out because they had a lot to deal with last season, right? The Bran characters and the Theon, like all that stuff was tied in together. And if you had introduced these other characters, it might have made things a little bit more complex.
Yeah, and absolutely. And they had so many characters to introduce last season.
Right.
But if you think about, I mean, we can talk about this later, but there are like six new characters we meet in this episode alone.
Right.
So, yeah, they pushed it this season, but you still, like, no matter where you push the introduction in Game of Thrones, you're always going to be contending with a bunch of new characters. Definitely. But yeah, it didn't hurt the story at all to have Jojen and Mira show up here. So here they are. Mira's a cool little funky spiky girl with her spear. She's a little Arya-like, so we like her.
Right. And I guess I'm skipping ahead a little bit, but in terms of general impressions of this episode, this was definitely one of those kind of transition episodes.
And what place
I mean,
setting.
What I mean by that is, yeah, table setting, place setting, whatever you want to call it. Not that much happens in this episode, and I'm not saying that necessarily as a complaint, because without the sort of table setting, you wouldn't have really awesome payoffs later in the season. They're just not really, but these types of episodes are just not as enjoyable to me as, you know, probably what we're going to get later on this season. I don't know how you feel about that, Joanna.
Well, you know, I watched this episode and then I sort of saw everyone's feedback, which seemed to be to agree with you in terms of they didn't find this episode very exciting. And then I rewatched the episode actually a couple times, and I don't know. I really liked this episode, and I think maybe it's one of those things that when you revisit it after you see the payoff, it'll mean that much more to you. But the table setting that's happening in this episode is so well done, so finely drawn, and the new characters we got were so well done that it just really excited me. And maybe that's the book lover thing. Maybe it's like, I'm really excited about these new characters, and I think they nailed it, so I'm really excited, you know?
Well, I will say that a lot of the scenes are really badass. Like, there's the introduction of the Brotherhood, for example, I thought was very impressive.
Right.
But there is also stuff in this episode that is, I thought, really poorly done as well. So let's
talk about that.
Let's move on. So the introduction of Judge and Reed. Then we have a continuation of the Rob, Talisa, and Roose Bolton storyline with Kat. They receive word from River Run and Winterfell. Winterfell, we know, has been burned to the ground by Theon and his men, or mostly Theon's men, right? Not Theon, because he was probably unconscious at the time. And remind us about River Run, Joanna. What was the state of River Run last time we saw it?
I don't have this show. Has the show been to River Run?
I don't know. That's kind of why I'm asking you.
I don't think the show's ever taken us to River Run. River Run is where Catelyn Stark grew up. And so that's where the House Tully is located. I believe we've never seen River Run.
And that's different than the place with where Tyrion was imprisoned and Kat's sister was, right?
Right, exactly. That's the Eyrie.
Right, that's right.
Yeah. So River Run is where the House Tully, that's their home, and we haven't seen it yet. But yeah, so they get double bad news, and the bad news is that Catelyn's father, Lord Halster Tully, is dead, and then also that maybe Bran and Rickon are dead. Right. They don't know. And the difference, you know, I talked about this last season. Actually, this difference actually kind of bothers me because it's important, I think, that Catelyn and Rob get the news that Bran and Rickon are dead before she gets it, right before she lets Jaime go, and he gets it right before he marries the woman that he marries. And so it's out of grief and despair and, you know, uncontrolled emotions that they make these two really bad decisions, basically. And
now, in the books also, is the River Run thing, like, is there a scene there? Like, is that explained, or is it just explained kind of, is it kind of like a three-sentence explanation and you don't really know what's going on?
No, I mean, in the book, actually, Catelyn is at River Run.
I see.
And her father's dying for a while, and then he dies. So they move them to Harrenhal instead. That's why I was like, that's why I'm really confused about what they're doing with Harrenhal, because Catelyn's supposed to be at River Run. But anyway, just news is that her father's dead. And yeah, there's a lot more explanation of that in the book, but I don't think that we miss it that much. I mean, it might seem confusing and out of the blue, but I think the payoff, you'll see, it won't really matter.
Yeah. Well, Patrick S. wrote in this week at acastofkings@gmail.com, and he kind of agreed with your confusion last week. He said, the two of you identified a weak area in the season 3 premiere episode, Harrenhal. It wasn't obvious even to book readers what had transpired here. The clues were pretty subtle. Roose Bolton was suggesting Rob start getting things set up to siege Harrenhal, with Rob doubting that the Mountain would even try to defend the old crumbling ruin. At that point, a scout riding up to report that the castle appeared deserted might have been a nice bridge for the scene where Rob's army marches into the interior of Harrenhal to find the dead Northmen and Rivermen prisoners left behind by the Mountain's men.
The thing I noticed upon like my fourth rewatch of that episode were carrion birds circling Harrenhal.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's what Rob is like, well, it doesn't look to me like we're going to get a fight. And I think that's because he saw, like, you know, vultures.
Very
basically.
Subtle. Very
yeah.
Subtle.
Super subtle. So, you know, and I wouldn't – Harrenhal is such a creepy place that I wouldn't be surprised if there are constantly vultures circling around it anyway. But I don't know if that was sort of their shorthand for this is what's happening. But I don't know. Anyway.
So then there's this pretty awesome transition from when Kat asks, have you heard anything from Theon at all? And Rob says no. And we haven't heard anything from Theon at all either for the last episode. And then we sort of smash cut to Theon waking up in this horrible medieval-esque dungeon. We don't know where he is. We don't know who's torturing him. We don't know for what. And it's a pretty... pretty uncomfortable scene, and sort of at the end of this episode, there's this notion that he might be rescued by someone that his sister sent. But yeah, it's, you know, this show has showed kind of medieval torture previously, and it has always been a really uncomfortable experience. And they generally don't shy away from some, like, really graphic violence, and this episode was no exception. When they really... like, the camera was super close up on Theon's fingernail as this guy stuck his knife under it.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, I recoiled. It was really, really uncomfortable to see. But also kind of you expect a show like this to be as gritty and unflinching and uncompromising in how it depicts these acts of violence. What did you think of this whole Theon storyline? You obviously know what happens with Theon. Don't give that away. But when you read that section in the book and you were watching this scene, did you feel like they skimped on the violence? Did you think they went overboard? Did they get it just right, like Goldilocks?
Okay, I've been thinking, ever since I watched this episode, I've been thinking about how I'm going to talk about this.
Yes.
Honestly, thinking long and hard about it. And I really think it's safe for me to say this.
Okay. Tread softly, Joanna.
I'm treading softly. Theon does not show up in book three, A Storm of Swords.
All right.
And this is what I've been alluding to this whole time of like sometimes characters don't show up for an entire book. Theon doesn't. You hear about him, but you don't see him at all.
I see.
So.
Well, that doesn't answer my question.
Well, it does,
I guess it does. I guess it
there
does.
There is
well,
no passage in the book. I mean, except,
okay, I see.
You know?
Well, it sounded like you were saying that maybe he might have shown up in a subsequent book and that book's plot lines were merged into this season, but you're saying that's not even the case.
Well, I am saying that. I just didn't know if I could say that. But yeah, okay. Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, that doesn't really give that much away, but.
Right.
So suffice to say, right, like, however you, are you saying that what was depicted here, you didn't even hear about at all in the book, or are you saying it was in the book in some form, either book
in
three
some
or four?
Form. In some form, yeah.
Okay, and if that's the case, did you think that this was a good depiction of that?
This is tame compared to what's in the book.
Really? Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be the case in general with the book's violence compared to the show's violence. We actually missed one of the best jokes from last episode.
What was that?
When Cersei says something along the lines of, Tyrion. They said your nose got cut off, but I guess it's not that bad.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Because Tyrion's nose did in fact get cut off in the book, right?
Right.
So that was kind of a bonus for book readers there.
Yes.
Anyway, whatever the case, this sequence was really well done, and I just think Theon's story, like what impressed me so much about the show and kind of continues to impress me is the way that characters will move in and out of focus depending on what the main thrust of the season is. And Theon was very much one of the main characters. He was one of the characters driving the action in season two. Now kind of reduced to a side character who is separate from the action and whose fate is unclear. And I think this scene takes you kind of out of the rest of this episode. Like, it kind of is very jarring, like, the uncertainty around what's going on with Theon. Really well done.
Yeah. And you get that in the books, too, in terms of, I've talked before about how there are point of view characters in different books. Like, Jaime Lannister is a point of view character in this book, but he hadn't been in books previous. So, obviously, Jaime Lannister is going to move more to the front, you know, the forefront, because you get inside his head. So the plot, you know, George R. R. Martin tries very hard, I think, to put one point of view character in each of the like locations where we're going.
Right.
So we get some insight into what's happening. But like, for example, Cersei and Joffrey are not point of view characters in Storm of Swords. So any scene where you have Cersei and Joffrey talking to each other, that's made up, you know, and Margaery isn't even a point of view character, you know, so there are a lot of scenes where they have to kind of make it up and they do a really good job, but it's because there are no spies in the room at that point, you know, they just sort of make it up. So
right that's interesting. But, that's interesting. But and let me point out, by the way, that I promised myself I would not give you a hard time about this, but telling me that Jaime is a point of view character kind of did give away that he would not be killed at the end of this episode.
That's not at the end of this episode, sure, but it means nothing for the books.
Okay, well, fair enough, because I guess
I think
go ahead.
I think it means nothing for the books.
Okay, because characters can be killed during their point of view chapters, I assume?
Yeah, I believe so.
All right,
yeah.
Well then, never mind. Then I'm not giving you a hard time for good reason.
This time.
Speaking of Jaime.
I mean, yeah, let me think about season one. Yeah, in the cold open of every single book,
right,
that character dies in their point of view chapter.
Right.
So, yeah, I think. Yeah, anyway. People can sure correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, speaking of Jaime and Brienne, excuse me, so they continue their wonderful banter in this episode. I posted this on my Tumblr like a year ago when season two was happening, but there was a graphic kind of indicating that the relationship between Jaime and Brienne is very similar to the relationship between Archer and Lana on the TV show Archer. If you're familiar with that, I thought that captured the dynamic really well. Jamie's just kind of Very witty, always doing things to try and drive Brienne insane. Occasionally it works. He's kind of needling her. He's talking to her about Lord Renly, saying that she fancied him. And that really gets her worked up. And I couldn't tell what it was exactly that was working her up. Was it the fact that he was kind of questioning Renly's honor, or was it the fact that he was accusing her of being attracted to him, which she was, or was it both? Do you have any thoughts, any insight you can provide on this, Joanna?
Well, yeah, I think, well, and he was pointing out the fact that Renly was gay, and she was like, no, he's not, which he is. Sorry, honey. but... Yeah, I think she was trying to deny that the reason she was loyal to him was that she was in love with him. But, you know, she was. And I don't know. I liked that interchange much more in the book, because he needles her about, you know, because she's on the run for killing Renly, right? And last season. And even though she didn't, she's on the run for that. And so he starts calling her Kingslayer, which is his nickname. And he's like, we're both Kingslayers. You're a Kingslayer. I'm a Kingslayer. She's like, I didn't kill him like a smoke shadow did. He's like, oh, I should have used that story. A smoke shadow killed the king, not me. So I don't know. It became less about like teasing, though he does that too. But the teasing is merciless from Jaime to Brienne. And I think those actors are doing such a magnificent job with their roles. So
Definitely. Well, the episode concludes with the fight scene that we've been waiting for, you know, six however many episodes, where they finally get to battle each other, and Jaime finally gets to find out if he measures up to Brienne's swordsmanship. Pretty decent fight scene, I thought. Pretty well shot, pretty well choreographed, and Brienne is victorious.
Well, yeah, because he's been in a cell for, you know, however long. His muscles sort
he's
of
also
wasting
wearing
away.
Chains,
and he's wearing chains.
So
but,
not really a fair fight, let's be honest.
And she's taller than him and stronger than him. But when I loved the look on his face when he got the sword in his hand, and he was like, this is his passion, is sword fighting. And he's like, oh, finally, I've got a sword back in my hand. Like, this is how it's supposed to be. And then he's so cocky. And then, yeah, he doesn't get pummeled. Like, he puts up a fairly decent fight, but he gets beaten, so yeah.
And then there's this kind of holy crap moment when these people ride up on them, right? And it's Bolton's bannermen. You don't know who they're – are they Lannister men? Are they Stark men? I wasn't sure, at least. Have we seen Noah Taylor before in this season?
No, and we do know who they are, Dave, not just book readers, I promise. This is not a spoiler. Roose Bolton is one of Rob's men.
No. I know. What I mean is, like, when they first showed up, I wasn't 100% sure who he was.
Oh, and then Jaime goes, oh, House Bolton. Okay.
Right, that's right.
Then
that's right.
You knew. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah.
Noah Taylor, who I love. He's a great actor.
Yeah, so, he's great. Actor. He's great and has this really specific look. I think they added a scar to his face.
Yeah, I think so.
Very distinctive, very threatening, very menacing. I really liked his work, and I think he was in... Submarine. He was in 2010's film Submarine.
Yes,
the Richard Ayoade movie. It was pretty,
playing the
pretty
dad.
Great in that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the fate of Jaime and Brienne is really unclear now, and I just don't think it's going to go well for either of them. That's just my really astute observation, Joanna. That's just
I did like the fade out of Brienne like with her sword
right.
up, like slowly backing away, like she's going to take these men or whatever. So
yeah, I mean, so that's kind of a question, right? Like, did you ever see that movie, The Rock?
Yeah, of course.
Where
it's at San Francisco. Of course, I've seen it.
Where the Commander Anderson is going up against Ed Harris's men, and he says, you know I can't stand down, and then they all die. What is Brienne's place? Is she allowed to stand down and surrender Jaime, or does she fight to the death?
I
suspect that she's going to stand down, but I just mean, like, from her whole thing is honor, honor, honor. I didn't know if there are any rules in the Game of Thrones universe that would force her to fight this out to the death.
Oh, yeah. I think there's rules in terms of she's sworn to Catelyn. She's got one job, which is to keep Jaime alive and to deliver him to King's Landing, and they're there to take Jaime back to the Stark men.
Right.
So I think she would fight tooth and nail to protect him. And one thing I want to say about the fight, I did just reread the chapter where they fought in the book. And they describe it's very sexy, actually, weirdly. Like, they keep talking about the swords kissing, and then when they're caught, she's like, she's got him on the ground and she's on top of him, and Jamie says something about, like, it looks like we're caught, like, fucking instead of fighting or whatever. So I don't know, it was just a very, like, sexually charged scene, which
didn't really come across that much in the
show.
Yeah,
not at all. No. So anyway,
all right, so then King's Landing, right? Let's talk about some King's Landing action.
Let's do it.
More discussion between Cersei and Joffrey, and I'm beginning to really love the interaction between these characters. I mean, this is something that's been building since season one. You saw it evolve in season two, and Joffrey seems to have totally lost all respect for his mom. I mean, he never had that much to begin with. Just by the fact that he killed Ned Stark, right, is evident that he wasn't really going to pay attention to her too much. But I don't know. It seemed kind of interesting, seeing as how she, as terrible of a human being as she is, she does know what she's doing. And so for Joffrey to continue to totally disregard her, not only disregard her, but demean her in the way that he is, seems to me to be a pretty dangerous game. But done so well by these two actors. I really feel like they are well matched as actors, despite the fact that there's probably a huge age difference between the two of them.
Right.
What did you think of this interaction? Oh, and also I should mention that it seems to me that Cersei continues to feel threatened by Margaery, right? That she's trying to convey to Joffrey, don't let this woman get too close. She has her own machinations, and Joffrey is kind of like, I don't really give a crap what you think.
It is a good match, but what do you think of her? She's beautiful and intelligent.
Yes, she is.
Her concern with the well-being of the common people is interesting.
Not to me.
I only meant that to go out of your way to endanger yourself.
It's becoming one of the most boring conversations I've ever had.
Margaery Tyrell dotes on filthy urchins for a reason. She dresses like a harlot for a reason. She married a traitor and known degenerate like Renly Baratheon for a reason.
She married Renly Baratheon because she was told to. That's what intelligent women do. What they're told.
I'm not 100% sure if he's saying that because he doesn't respect her at all or if he actually kind of favors Margaery. My suspicion is that it's the latter and doesn't want to listen to any of his mom's objections.
It's definitely the latter by the end of the episode.
Right.
We can talk more about that later. But yeah. I think, yeah, I love the way that Cersei's like, he's holding a scrap of cloth and she's like, maybe she can use that for her wedding dress. It's certainly enough fabric. Like, Cersei is such a mean girl and she's trying to get Joffrey to mean girl with her. She's like, so that was pretty interesting the way she went in among the peasants. Pretty stupid, huh? You know, and Joffrey's not biting at all. So,
I mean, what I did find refreshing was the fact that somebody on the actual show acknowledged how scantily clad Margaery is most of the time. So it kind of broke the fourth wall a little bit, Joanna.
Well, she did in the first episode too. She was like, "Oh, you aren't cold?" And Margaery's like, "No, I'm dandy. I'm all about my midriff being, you know." Anyway, I also
careful, Joanna. We don't want people to think you're complaining about the nudity on Game of Thrones too much.
There's no nudity this episode, guys.
That's oh my gosh, shocking, right?
It was a bummer.
It was just...
What will I even talk about?
Yeah, definitely. So should we talk about the rest of the Joffrey scenes right now, or should we move on?
I think we should talk about Sansa first.
Okay, let's talk about Sansa. So Shay and Sansa discuss Littlefinger, and they kind of have this ominous conversation. Let me just say, this is, again, in my opinion, a scene... Like, this whole storyline is of... telling and not showing. And I say that disparagingly. Like, I don't feel like there's any sketchiness between Sansa and Littlefinger other than what the characters have actually said explicitly. Because Littlefinger is just a sketchy guy. He's not doing anything beyond what he normally does. Do you know what I mean? In my opinion, what do you think?
Yeah, but Sansa's a dummy. She's a little bit of a dummy. And, like, she doesn't realize how manipulative Littlefinger is. Like, she doesn't realize his – I don't think she realizes his role in betraying her father. And so I don't think she's properly wary. And that's what Shay's trying to instill, the proper degree of wariness in her. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's right. You know, just between
– He's talking about – he's trying to convince Sansa to go away with him. And Shay basically does not think that's a smart idea. And Sansa, who is like, no, he's a friend of my mother and it makes sense. You know, yeah, I understand he's a little whatever. And she's like, no, he's a lot whatever, basically.
Right, right.
Does that make sense? Yeah, it does explained make sense. It very eloquently, so.
Yeah, it does make sense. It just seems as though, I don't know. Like,
I'll tell you the reason why it's going on, though.
Maybe you shouldn't?
No, I should. I should.
Okay.
It has nothing to do with future instances. I'll tell you that when we wanted to have this scene with Shay and Tyrion that happens later, where Shay is really obnoxious. Is she not in that scene where she's super jealous that he like had sex with Roz and then he had sex?
I thought
the
whole
like,
scene was obnoxious. Actually, that was one of my least favorite scenes of the entire series of Game of Thrones.
Oh yeah, ever. I agree completely. It was terrible.
Yes,
but. It's better. This Shay is better than the Shay in the book because the Shay in the book goes to see Tyrion because she wants to go to a ball and she's bored and she's not Sansa's handmaid at all in the
Wait,
book.
When you
and
say so she wants to go to a ball.
Oh, she wants to go to Joffrey's wedding.
Oh, basically. She wants to go to like that kind of ball. Okay.
Yeah. Oh, come on now. And like she shows up. She's like, why can't I go in my velvets and my jewels? Why can't I? Like she's worse in the book than she is in the show. And I think they're trying to give her some sort of depth in the show. Like she's looking after Sansa and she's trying to – it seems like she almost has a legitimate reason to go to Tyrion. So I feel like they're trying to give her depth. They just – I don't know if it's the performance of the actress or what's going on, but it's not working.
Which is quite weak in my opinion.
Yeah. It's not working very well. Yeah. So –
But no, that's good context. It's good to know that they're trying to make this utterly unlikable character somewhat more likable.
Yeah, she's yards smarter in the show than she is in the book. So, you know, they're trying.
I just think this storyline is, I don't know. I just don't think it's that artfully done. Maybe in the end, whatever transpires between Littlefinger and Sansa, it's all going to lock into place. I'm going to say, wow, they really laid the seeds of that, really like planted the seeds really well in episodes 1 and 2. But I have a bad feeling about this plot line. That's all.
Okay.
And how it's going to be executed. So then Sansa goes and speaks with Margaery and Lady Olyanna, who is the Queen of Thorns. Cool name, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so she is Margaery's grandmother and kind of presumably a powerful political force in the Game of Thrones universe, I assume, right? Is that correct?
Sort of. I mean, she's sort of a figurehead. She's not, you know, yes. The family has a ton of money. She's a figurehead, powerful person in the family.
Do they have Lannister-esque levels of money?
I think the Lannisters have more coin and the Tyrells have more, like, goods.
I see.
Crops and, you know, that sort of stuff. So... I don't think they're quite as rich as the Lannisters, but I mean, no one is, but they're a powerful ally and they have tons of soldiers and that sort of thing. So bannermen, I should say. Anyway, let's just talk about how Olyanna is one of the best characters ever. And she shows up and Diana Rigg knocked it out of the park and it was so enjoyable. And if you watch Downton Abbey, she was basically the Dowager Countess. Like she was so Maggie Smith. It was fantastic. And I loved the scene. Did you like the scene?
Yeah, I thought it was great. I think the scene really hangs on the Sansa character. I think like it without her amazing performance, it would not have worked because this scene is really the first time that Sansa can be truly honest about all the horrors that have befallen her. Right? Am I right about that? Like, have there been other times when she's been able to open up about what a terrible person Joffrey is?
Not that we've seen. We haven't seen her open up, no.
Right.
Yes, he had that reputation, and they named him traitor and took his head.
Joffrey. Joffrey did that. He promised he would be merciful, and he cut my father's head off. And he said that was mercy. And he took me up on the walls and made me look at it.
Go on.
I can't. I never meant. My father was a traitor. My brother as well. I have traitor's blood. Please don't make me say any more.
She's terrified, Grandmother. Just look at her.
Speak freely, child. We would never betray your confidence. I swear it.
He's a monster.
Oh. That's a pity.
So Sophie Turner really did an amazing job here, and the way that shot of her was framed was quite masterful, because it was totally symmetrical. I don't know if you saw, which is atypical for shooting a scene of dialogue. You don't usually shoot it perfectly symmetrical, but it kind of gave, and she was framed kind of by that doorway, and it kind of gave this sense that she was being, I don't know, she was so small, kind of in the middle of this world, caught in between these impulses that she had of being honest and telling Marjorie the truth, and versus not endangering herself. Still not clear to me exactly kind of what is the state of Sansa at this point, right? Like, is she? She's obviously still consuming resources of the kingdom, right? She has traitor's blood. She's no longer betrothed to Joffrey. So they're just kind of letting her just chill out and kind of be
She's a prisoner, basically. I mean, she's a well-kept prisoner, but she's a prisoner of war because she's a major chess piece.
Got it.
Because against the Starks. So she's a well-treated prisoner.
Right, and she knows that she could be, beaten or abused or more things happen to her, like, at any time. So she doesn't want to jeopardize her state of being well-kept. But at the same time, these people seem so nice. This Tyrell family seems so nice, and they seem, like, so well-intentioned, and they're like, we have this cone of silence. We're not going to tell anyone. And I just felt this wave of relief when Sansa was finally able to say, oh, Joffrey did X, Y, Z, and was able to fully explain the depths of his horror. But it was kind of this, I don't know how to put it. At the one hand, it was this relief, but there was still this kind of hopelessness attached to it, because it wasn't like the Queen of Thorns made any promise about what would happen. Like, wow, thanks for letting us know. We're definitely going to do something about it. It was just kind of like, oh, thanks for letting us know. Appreciate it. We'll take that into account. Meanwhile, Sansa has just poured out her entire heart and is...
I think there's what they offer is the relief of her finally being able to tell the truth. And be honest. She's been keeping up appearances for so long. And, they offer her safety. They say, we're just women here. We're not going to do anything. We're not going to betray you. And not that they're promising to do anything to help her, which is a little different than the book, but, that they're not going to betray her. So, right. And that must be a comfort for this poor girl who's been trapped for so long. And she's so young. So I agree that Sophie Turner did an amazing job of just sort of letting it all go.
Yeah. All right. So then at this point in the episode, we go back to Catelyn and Talisa. Catelyn is making something, right? What do you know what she's making here?
Oh, God. I'm sorry. I don't know the official name for it. She was doing it in season one,
right,
for Bran. And it's
she's making
it looks
the,
like
Blair
a dream
Witch,
catcher.
The Blair Witch dream catcher, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Is what she's making. Let's just call it that.
Yeah.
And opens up to Talisa here. It's not 100% clear to me. I've said the phrase, it's not 100% clear to me throughout the course of this episode. But what do you think Catelyn feels towards Talisa at this point?
I think she doesn't dislike her as a person, but as they keep hammering home, she's just, this is just the biggest mistake in the whole world. You get the scene right before with Lord Karstark and Rob,
right,
where he's like, basically, in marrying this woman, you've lost us the war. Because what they don't show is that he not only betrayed Walder Frey, Lord Frey, but he lost, like, in doing this, he then loses all of his Frey soldiers. So when Karstark says, we have half the men, like, he could be talking about, like, half our men have been killed, but I think what he means is half our men done rode away because you married this woman and you lost us half our army. Which is the other side of the coin of the Margaery Tyrell Joffrey marriage, where they're gaining all the Tyrell army forces in that marriage. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
Rob just made the biggest tactical error. And so I think Catelyn doesn't dislike Talisa as a person, and she's inclined to be soft-hearted, you know, because she loves her son and she wants her son to be happy. But I mean, it's just, it's doom basically. And I don't know. That's how I read it. How do you read it?
Yeah, that sounds right to me. That sounds right to me.
Okay.
And Catelyn has this scene, but at the same time, right? Like, you're right. She doesn't dislike her as a person. You don't open up and spill your guts out to someone who you hate, right? Unless it's very special circumstances. So she understands that Talisa is important in Rob's life, but she also doesn't fully accept her because of the horrible tactical decision this is. At the same time, recognizes enough that she's a member of the family that she's willing to tell her this terrible secret that she's kept for the entire first two seasons that we have not found out yet, which is that in her mind, she thought that she had the power to kill Jon Snow and then save Jon Snow, but didn't live up to her part of the bargain.
So I pray to all seven gods. Let the boy live. Let him live. And I'll love him. I'll be a mother to him. I'll beg my husband to give him a true name. To call him Stark and be done with it. To make him one of us.
And he lived.
And he lived. And I couldn't keep my promise. And everything that's happened since then. All this horror that's come to my family. All because I couldn't love a motherless child.
And I thought she did an amazing job delivering this speech here. It's a really powerful scene. I mean, when she says all these horrible things that have befallen us have been because of me, I don't know that I fully... it's kind of like there's this kind of uncertainty there, right? The uncertainty that one would have about anything that's religion-related in the modern day, right? If someone said, oh, I made this promise to God that if he got me out of that situation, I would serve him forever. And then I did get out of that situation, but I didn't serve him, and now we're in this terrible mess. You know, it's kind of like, okay, right?
Right.
That may be true, but we have no way of knowing if that's the reason, right? So there, while I did find the speech very moving, I also enjoyed the fact that there's this kind of uncertainty in her voice about, did she really cause all this to happen? You know, there's this whole separate religion in Game of Thrones. Anyway, I'm rambling. What did you think of this scene?
It was okay. It was fine. It's not at all in the book. And so it's just this thing they made up, I think, to try to make Catelyn seem more approachable. Because she's, I mean, it is her fault. You know what I mean? It was sort of the... You know, in capturing Tyrion, she kind of started the whole war, basically. Or one could say in pushing Bran out of the tower, they started the war. But in capturing Tyrion in season one, that was the first major tactical blunder, I think.
Interesting, and, because my understanding of the scene was that what she was saying was that because she didn't keep her promise to the gods, that's why all this bad luck.
No, I agree. I agree with you, but I'm just saying for her to have this character say, it's all my fault, I think that's almost fan service because I think a lot of people are all, it's all Catelyn Stark's fault. So to have it come out of the character's mouth maybe makes us more, you know, kindly disposed towards her because she said that, you know, when we feel that way about her. I don't know.
Interesting. I mean, I will say, yeah, I thought this was one of the most effective scenes in the whole show. I'm sorry, in this episode.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think I think there is a tendency to I don't want to make any accusations here, Joanna, but do you think that maybe sometimes there's a tendency to devalue scenes if they are not in the book?
If I think they're not great and they're not from the book, yes. But like last season we had stuff with like Tywin and Arya. I thought that all stuff was great. None of it was in the book and I thought it was masterful. So I think I'm more of a harsh judge of things that are not from the book because I really want to think about why did they include this?
Right.
You know, I'm kind of like, okay, you know, like if a scene from the book doesn't work, I'm like, okay, well, they didn't execute that as well as they could have. If they've added a scene, then I'm kind of like, okay, well, what purpose does this serve ultimately? And, you know, that they cut something else in order to put this in here. And, you know, so I don't think like I'm predisposed to dislike it. I'm just, there's that extra layer of criticism that I have on top of it.
Fair enough.
Do you think those are two different ways of thinking?
No, I think that's a good point. I think that's fine. That's very fair. I guess it's inherently unfair, but whatever.
Right. I'm cool. But whatever.
I'm cool with it.
Okay. Cool.
All right. Anyway, she opens up to Talisa, and they have this moment of bonding together. And I think, let me recalibrate, I guess. I thought it was pretty good scene. Not one of the best scenes of all of Game of Thrones, but certainly not one of the worst scenes of this episode, of which there was one that... I don't see it on this rundown here. We already talked about the Tyrion and Shae scene enough, we think?
I think so. It was terrible. We hated it.
Yeah, that was it was really, awful. Really terrible. Like, I found it totally, not only totally insufferable, but just poorly written. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I just did not believe any moment that was going on.
I agree.
And it didn't seem to advance the plot at all. It served almost no purpose in my mind. So, all right.
I understand, like, you know, in my obnoxious way, I can say I understand why it was there, but I didn't like it. I thought it was poorly done. So
let's talk a little bit about what's going on north of the wall. But actually, before we get to that, we're already like 40 minutes into this episode. So why don't we take a minute to thank our sponsors for this episode, Joanna?
Let's do it.
So the Cast of Kings podcast is only here because those of you who are listeners decided it was worth contributing some funding to. And we really appreciate all the people that donated any amount of money to a Cast of Kings. But there were some people who claimed some sponsorship spots. We want to thank those people in particular this week. We want to thank Chris Farrell from the Screeners Cast podcast. And John Robinson, do you know what the world could always use more of?
What could the world always use more of, Dave?
High-quality podcast, Joanna.
High-quality podcast, indeed.
High-quality podcast. And particularly, high-quality podcasts featuring four friends who have all had some career in video production at some point. That is really, there's a need for expertise as opposed to just people who have no idea what the hell they're talking about, like us, just rambling.
Like
about
us. Yeah. Exactly. We have no insider knowledge.
Exactly right. Why listen to our show at all when you could go to a place that where people actually know what they're talking about and listen there? So you can find the Screeners Cast the Screeners Podcast at screenerspodcast.com. You can also email them at screenerscast@gmail.com and follow them on Twitter at screenerscast. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, it's Chad, Chris, Melody, and Josh. And they, between them, in their little fingers, probably have way more insider knowledge
than
me.
Little fingers.
Yeah, you like it? It's a Game of Thrones reference.
Game of Thrones reference. Dropping the Game of Thrones names down there. But Chad is a pro who spends pretty much his entire waking life immersed in some kind of video production. Chris is a sci-fi and action nerd from way back who might be Michael Bay's only serious fan. Not true, Chris. There's definitely at least one more fan on this podcast. Melody, a mom and a Trekkie, but we rarely hold that against her. I don't know why you'd hold that against her. Just putting that out there. And Josh, an armchair philosopher who occasionally leaves the house to see a movie, which he almost invariably hates, unless Wes Anderson made it. That's kind of like me, except substitute unless for especially if. Chad, Chris, Melody, and Josh have a great time doing the Screeners podcast, which is releasing every other week. They're always looking for feedback from listeners, so check out their podcast on iTunes, as well as on Facebook, Twitter, at ScreenersCast, on email at screenerscast@gmail.com. And on the web at www.screenerspodcast.com. That's www.screenerspodcast.com. There's also a bunch of people who donated at least $10 each, Joanna Robinson. The very least. They may have donated more than that, but we are going to thank them for donating at the very least $10. Joanna Robinson, you want to start naming some of these awesome people?
Yes. I want to thank Max Rothschild, Brad Dancer, Derek Peterson, Ranjan Rajan, Lainey Bobaney, Sean Welsh, Sean Stringfield, and John Hewer.
Thank you guys so much. We also got to thank Crystal Bailey, Chad Maya, Craig Smith, Kip Palalis, Mark Rossini, Kevin Perez, Lord Trent of House Palmer, which is what the name he wrote down was, and Patrick Stedham, as well as John Paul Lawrence. Thank you so much.
Thanks, John Paul.
Hey, John, I think you should read it Max Rambles.
Max Rambles?
Yeah, because on the right side, that's what they want their name to be pronounced as.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Can Max you just read all your names again?
Yeah.
So hold on. Let's
well, just... I think it's Rossini. I don't think it's Rossini.
Okay. We should have done each other's names.
I know.
What? First of all, it says Rossini. How is that pronunciation guide helped me pronounce Rossini?
It doesn't.
It's terrible.
But, yeah. Okay.
Okay. Let's do this again.
Max Rambles.
Let me make a timestamp here.
Okay. Live podcasting, everybody.
Yeah. We also have to thank Joanna, all the people that donated $10 to our show. People that donated $10 won the privilege of having us thank them by name. So big thanks to all the following people, including Crystal Bailey, Chad Maya, Craig Smith, Kip Palalis, Mark Rossini or Rossini, I'm not sure which one because the pronunciation guide he provided is no help, Kevin Perez, Lord Trent of House Palmer, Patrick Stedham, John Paul Lawrence, and who else, Joanna Robinson? Who else should we thank today?
I'm going to go on record and say I think it's Rossini.
All right.
And I'm going to thank Max Rambles, Brad Dancer, Derek Peterson, Ranjan Rajan, Lainey Bobaney, Sean Welsh, Sean Stringfield, and John Hewer. Thanks, guys, so much. We really appreciate it.
In what world is Max Rambles pronounced Max Rambles? That's what I want to know.
Rambles. I'm sorry. Do you want to do it again?
No, it's okay. I'm just messing with you now. We're going to leave this in. So okay. What you guys haven't been hearing is the 8 takes that we did of that one bit of reading the names. So
John Paul Lawrence is really hard to pronounce.
I agree. Work on that, John Paul. All right. So let's go north of the wall, Joanna Robinson. What happens north of the wall? We have another scene with Mance and John.
Do you feel like – okay, so I was really happy that they put this in because like one of your major issues last week was like I don't understand why Mance Rayder was convinced so easily. And then right off the bat he's like, if you're playing as false, it won't be hard to kill you, which is what I was trying to tell you, which is that I didn't think Mance Rayder was convinced. He was like, all right, I'm going to keep you around. It's like keep your enemies closer. He's keeping him around, but he's not trusting him.
You know? I mean, let me just say that we got a lot of emails, a lot of comments about this, and it's still pretty sharply divided, Joanna. I think a lot of people – agreed with me that the Jon Snow storyline and the setup for it was totally lame, and other people thought, oh, that was totally adequate in explaining. And of course, Mance doesn't trust Jon. My beef is not the idea that Mance suddenly trusts Jon. The whole suspicion that Mance has of Jon, like, that's totally understandable. I get that. That's conveyed well. It's okay. The whole setup to get to that point in the story makes no sense whatsoever. Oh, John! Yes. John killed Corrin Halfhand. I love someone in the comments at Slash Home brought this up. Dude, Corrin Halfhand was basically restrained and surrounded by 50 wildlings. There's no way he was going to survive that. Like anyone could have incidentally killed Corrin Halfhand. It's not a huge deal that John killed Corrin Halfhand. At least the way it's set up in the show, in my opinion. So, yeah, that's a long way of saying no, Joanna.
Well, I thought your issue was with Mance trusting him. If your issue is with the way it was set up, I agree with you completely.
No, yeah, my issue is with Mance finding this even somewhat plausible. That's not the. I don't think Mance trusting him is the issue. It's Mance finding this somewhat at all plausible that Jon Snow wants to join them.
Okay.
So.
Well, what I'm saying is I don't think he does find it totally plausible.
No, I mean, I think he should find it implausible in ways that aren't what the show intends.
Right? Okay.
He should find it implausible because it makes no sense on any level.
Okay.
That being said, we get a really good sense of how difficult Mance's job is. It's hard out there for a ruler of the wildlings, man.
That's a catchy tune. We should write that.
Definitely. Hustle and flow. So, Hustle and Flow, Westeros edition. So, we have we just get a sense that, yeah, there's all these different clans and Mance is trying to be in charge of them. We're also introduced to some other magic, the ability to see through animals. Kind of cool, kind of well done in this scene. What'd you think?
Oh, I loved it. We've already seen that with – it's parallel to what Bran's doing. Like the wolf dreams that Bran has, as Jojen says in the episode, it starts with the dreams and then you can do it later. We've heard that term warg before used for Bran. And so we meet this character, Oren, played by Mackenzie Crook, a.k.a. Gareth from The British Office. I really love that guy. So, and the white eyeballs, like super creepy and awesome. So
yeah, and the way he kind of transitions out of the white eyeballs to regular eyeballs, I thought was really well done. Again, I don't have any beef with magic in the show in general. Like the rules of this are pretty well set up. They don't break the world, in my opinion. And so I thought that was a great scene.
Yeah.
So then, finally, we have a return to the Arya storyline. Let's take a pause here for a moment and just say that it does feel to me as though they are purposely excluding some storylines from each episode to concentrate on other storylines. Again, I just had this feeling that. And this may be totally wrong, but I feel like most of the episodes in season two felt the need to address every single plot line. Whereas it feels like they are much less obligated to that this season. Do you feel that way, or am I just imagining it? I don't know.
Yeah, I agree. And they, you know, last season, the Dany plotline was so problematic, I think, because they tried to beef it up to include her more.
Right.
Than she would have been otherwise. And so, yeah, I agree with you that it's great that they can just feel the need to leave her alone.
Right.
And, you know, we won't forget who Dany is and we'll come back to her.
And so no Dany this episode, which is too bad because the whole Unsullied situation was really interesting to me. But we finally find out what's happening with Arya. It's interesting, by the way, Arya and Bran look noticeably older than they did, last season, even though theoretically only a few days have transpired since last season. So I thought that was kind of amusing. But that's what happens when you hire children actors. So we finally get a continuation here of what's going on with them. They're on the run, and they encounter the Brotherhood Without Banners. Now, until this point, I did not even know that the Brotherhood was an actual real thing, or I did not know it would play a huge part in the story.
Right.
So they encounter them, and the head of the Brotherhood is played by Paul Kay, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Who I thought did a fantastic job in this episode. He just has this great quality to him. He's very charismatic.
Right from the start, you're like, who's this guy?
Yeah, who is it? Like, I can totally understand why people would follow him into the middle of the woods with no banner that he's waving and just do what he says. So I think he's really, really charismatic, rough around the edges, very likable, but also kind of has a very subdued menace to him. Like you get a sense that if you don't do what he says, he'll probably do something terrible to you. So I thought he captured, whatever this character is. I don't know what he was like in the book, but it felt really fully realized to me in the show. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, he was great. And I really liked the other brother that we saw, which was Anguy the Archer. I love that whole bit where he fired the arrow in the air and he's like, by the time I'm done talking, this is going to hit you in the head, basically. And I thought that was really beautifully done. I also love that Thoros enters singing The Reigns of Castamere. And it's sort of that whole world building where, you know, they have a culture, these songs that come up over and over again and, you know, these shared culture. So I thought that was a sweet little bit. And, you know, then they have that scene in the inn where he disarms Arya really quickly. Oh, the thing we should talk about, though, is when they open up on Arya, it addresses the thing that you and a lot of other people got really pissed about last season, which is why didn't Arya use one of her wishes to kill Tywin Lannister? The answer is because in the books he's not there. So that's the real answer. But Gendry is giving Arya all his crap. He's like, you had three wishes and you could have killed three people and you could have ended the war if you killed Tywin Lannister and you didn't. And Arya's like, no, I didn't. You know, like, I thought that was good fan service, like you talked about the nose getting cut off.
Yeah,
you know.
Except addressing a major, like just bringing up a major plot hole doesn't necessarily address it. You know, like pointing out that you did something stupid doesn't necessarily absolve you of it. Do you know what I'm saying?
No, I'm not saying it absolves. I just think I feel like that's why that was there, was to them fan service to be like, yeah, we know that that didn't make any sense.
Basically, I'm not letting the showrunners off the hook.
Okay, for that. That's fine.
Kind of what
that's
where I'm going.
Anyway, the Brotherhood was great. I thought they did a great job.
Right, so. And delivered a truly holy crap moment in this. Like, just an amazing moment because You have this scene where they have this hooded guy come into this inn. The same inn, by the way, where I believe Kat seized Tyrion, right?
It's the same set. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so it doesn't matter if it was actually the same place.
Right.
They bring in this guy. You don't know who it is. And when they unmask him, the way that scene is shot, right? And you just have this, holy crap, this guy can give away Arya's true identity. And then I thought back to how the Hound wanted to run away with Sansa last season. And I guess she chose the slightly less sketchy of the two male people to run away with. Sorry, what was that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I kind of felt bad for the Hound that he's just on his own doing God knows what, trying to get away from King's Landing.
Yeah. And all the fire, all the scary fire.
Yeah. So Arya was so close to getting out, Joanna.
So close.
So close.
So close.
And now who knows what the Brotherhood's going to do to her. I don't know. But it seems like she's...
They framed that so well. Speaking of framing, the last shot is like over the shoulder of Thoros and Sandor. And it's just like her face framed and this like, oh shit, look on her face. So
yeah.
I thought that was well done.
So then I think the only other thing we need to talk about this episode is the final scene with Margaery and Joffrey.
Right? Well, can I talk really quickly about Samwell Tarly?
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I kind of blocked that out of my mind, too. Continue.
I think we had a couple people write in or tweet at me or something that they're like, please give Sam a ton of crap for being a whiny crybaby. And
Joanna Robinson, I am not an objectivist by nature, but... I do think that here's a guy who apparently didn't send the ravens and who, you know, is now...
When was he supposed to send the ravens?
Okay. But has proven himself to be generally useless and now is becoming... Like, when you watch that scene, you either identify with Samwell or the guy who's complaining about Samwell, right? And I definitely identify with the guy who's complaining about Samwell way more, right?
Well, I identified with Ser Jorah. Lord Mormont. Sorry, not Ser Jorah. Lord Mormont. Where, like, he's a good leader. I mean, he yells at Sam, but he's not like, you're a stupid piece of shit, sit down in the snow and die. But he's like, get your shit together, Sam. We're marching. I just watched, this is a slight tangent, but it reminded me, I just watched The Grey this weekend for the first time. I hadn't seen it. Devendra actually told me to watch it. It was really, really good. And it reminded me a lot of this, where, like, you're at the end of your rope, and the end of Sam's rope might be sooner than most other people's. And I'm not saying I completely identify with Sam. I'm just saying
it's so soon that you can't tell the beginning of the rope from the end of the rope.
I guess
that's how soon it is.
But anyway, all right. You think Sam should have sat down in the snow and died right then and there? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, like. It's bad enough that he's useless. At least have the self-awareness, man. At least kind of think to yourself, okay, I'm useless. That's why you left me behind, but I'm going to make the most of this. But he's actively doing things that could endanger them even more this episode by kind of sitting down in the snow and crying. And that's just like, haven't you already done enough damage, Sam? Haven't you already done enough damage?
All right.
So
we can talk about Margaery now.
I just what a useless character. I don't know.
Okay.
Well, okay, answer the question, Joanna. Who do you identify more with? Samwell or
I don't identify with that psychopath who's like sit down in the snow and die right now.
Okay, well, that's where you and I differ, obviously. That's where you and I differ. Look, that's one way to view it, Joanna. Another way to view it is he's looking out for the the good of the unit. You know, he's looking out for his fellow Night's Watchmen. And if Samwell is just kind of sobbing into a corner and impeding their advancement, it's going to be bad for all of them. So.
Sure. Think of the many, not of the one.
That's right. Like, that's my point. That's my point. Also, he's probably just pissed at Sam. Both of those things. Okay. So then we have this final scene with Margaery and Joffrey. And let me just say, Joanna, it is in general difficult when a person is acting to tell whether or not they have a raging erection. But This is a scene where it was very clear that one of the characters definitely did have one of those.
Yeah, Marjorie's gown did not hide her erection, is what
That's
you're
right.
saying.
No, seriously, yeah. though, we have gotten hints that Joffrey is sexually aroused by violence before, but this really brought that to light. And I thought he's such a good actor because he conveys this absolutely sickening character so well. It in my opinion, it is not over the top. Do you know what I mean?
No.
He is not like, ooh, I have such a raging whatever right now. You know, he's just basically like, it's very subtle the way he says things and his kind of, the way his like smile is kind of really, there's a really, whew, really chilling menace and disturbing menace to him. But I was a little unclear as to what was going on at the beginning of the scene. She comes in. And Joffrey is holding his crossbow, which we know he only does when he's kind of pissed and wants to show his power. What are his feelings towards Marjorie at that point? Because the feeling I was left with at the opening scene with Cersei and Joffrey is that Joffrey kind of liked Marjorie. So that when she comes in and he kind of is making all these accusations about how she's betting a traitor and stuff like that, it did kind of confuse me. What am I missing? Am I missing something?
Well, I just think Cersei had sown some seeds, you
gotcha.
Know, that he likes her, but Cersei had dropped some, because that's exactly what Cersei had said earlier. And so he was just sort of like thinking about it and stewing on it. And so he said these things, and then Marjorie deflected it expertly.
Right, by kind of...
By outing Renly and talking about anal sex. Which she does. She's like, he got really drunk and he wanted to have sex with me in a way that would never produce a baby. And I was like, all right, Marjorie. Way to stay a lady and talk about anal sex at the same time.
So. Yeah, well played. Well played. Mm-hmm.
And speaking of playing, like, she plays him so well. She's armed with this knowledge that she got from Sansa that he's this little fucking sicko psychopath. And she just plays him perfectly.
Well, there's
I
also
thought it was
one,
amazing.
One of the most subtle things about this episode, I thought, was when he says, I've been thinking of outlawing such degenerate behavior. And she says, as is your right. But you can tell she's being insincere about it. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, because her bro is gay.
Right.
She's all for gay marriage, man.
Right. And,
yeah.
And I just thought that was just a great moment that she you know, comparing how Sansa lies to comparing how she lies is really great. Comparison, because she's expert at it and Sansa really isn't very good at it quite yet, you know? And so just an amazing contrast between the two of them.
Yeah,
so.
And I love that line she has where she says, the subtleties of politics are often lost on me. And I was like, nothing's lost on you, Marjorie.
Right.
She's got the whole game sewn up, so she's great.
I am very curious what her kind of plan was. Like, well, I'm also curious what her game was with saying, like, let me try using this weapon. Is she trying to sort of verify Sansa's claims, do you think, at this point?
Well, not only verify, but also just sort of play. You know, it's like if you find out that your partner has a kink of some sort and you want to please them in that way, you're like, well, let me play into that kink. You know, and that's what she's doing, basically. This is what excites him. And she's like, would that excite you to watch me do this? And he's like, yeah, it would. So
I see.
She's good at what she does, is what I'm saying.
She is a generous lover, I think, is really what, in modern terms, that's what we call her.
I mean, for Renly, she was as well. She's like, shall I call my brother in here? Would that help you?
So anyway, that takes us to the end of this week's episode. I think that's all the storylines. Noticeably missing, as we've already pointed out, no Daenerys and no Davos, no Melisandre, no Stannis this episode. Anything else that we missed this episode, Jonna?
Oh, I'm sure. I hope people will tell us if we did.
Yeah, I can't think of any other major plot lines, but I have a feeling I'm forgetting one or two. But yeah, again, loving this new approach of feeling free to leaving out some plot lines. I think that is the best approach. I think they learned their lesson, especially because they're introducing new characters left and right, right? Like, you have to be very careful how many characters you introduce and how much time you spend on them, or else the audience will stop caring.
Right.
So I think they've done a good job here. What did you think of this episode overall? You liked it?
I loved it, but I can see how people would get, you know, who don't know what's coming or whatever. Like, I hate to sound, I like don't want to sound smug or anything like that. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that
sound pretty
for
smug.
Me,
pretty smug.
Well, that's just my voice. for me, like I said, I was so pleased with all of the new characters we met and the excellent job they did with the casting and the direction that, you know, I really love this episode for that. And the conclusion is very exciting with Jamie and Brienne and what's going to happen. Good cliffhanger. So,
yeah, I thought it was all right. Certainly not bad. Some really great moments. The moment when the Hound is unmasked. There is just some really great kind of oh my gosh moments that you would expect from Game of Thrones, and this episode does deliver. Some weak stuff, right? The Shay plotline continues to disappoint. And overall, just not that much really happens this episode. So it was all right. Not my least favorite episode, but certainly not my favorite. I have a feeling it's just setting up the best that is yet to come. So, all right, that is
your optimism, Dave Chen.
Yeah, there you go. That is our discussion of Dark Wings and Dark Words, the second episode of this season of Game of Thrones. Let's get to emails, Gianna Robinson. Emails.
Let's do it.
So, got a lot of emails this week. You can always email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. Peter from Ayer, Massachusetts wrote in regards to magic, while I don't think the rules need to be explicitly outlined, I do think the show needs to do a better job showing the cost/repercussions of magic. In the books, Martin's magic system is more poetic than it is rules-based, but he makes it clear this kind of magic doesn't come easily. Melisandre is one of the most powerful magic users in the series, but that doesn't mean she can just conjure smoke babies whenever she pleases. And don't get me started on Pyat Pree as multiple man, or little girls who can randomly teleport, as if a poisonous scorpion isn't scary enough. There's a reason such nonsense wasn't in the books. Once you establish that teleportation is possible, doesn't that change everything? I'd also like to agree that with Dave that Jon Snow's reasons for joining the Wildlings weren't properly set up. A single conversation with Corran Halfhand toward the end of season 2 could have fixed this. In the book, Corran stresses the need for Jon to infiltrate the Wildlings and encourages him to do what is necessary when the time comes in order to gain their trust. It seems to me this could have easily been addressed, but I suppose they would have had to lose another scene, like Joffrey beating whores with his scepter. I think we can all agree that scene was pretty great and not the least bit gratuitous. So I just really enjoyed this email. Again, we've pointed out a lot of people disagreed with me and a lot of people agreed with me. This is one of the emails that agreed with me. But Joanna, I did not know that the teleportation was not in the books. Can you vouch for this?
I can vouch for that.
So that makes me even more angry.
I feel like I talked about that last season, but I could be wrong.
I think you're right about that. But yeah, that makes me even more.
The manticore, the quote-unquote magic scorpion, the manticore, is in the book. So I don't know.
Right.
But the teleportation is not. So there you
right.
go.
And Peter makes a good point here, which is that once you establish teleportation possible, doesn't that change everything? Which is to say, there's no reason Pyat Pree should ever be defeated by anything. The teleportation is such an amazing power. That the ability to overcome that with fire, right? It just seems really
not pretty. Just any fire, dragon fire. Maybe it just elevates the impressiveness of the dragon fire.
Okay.
Not okay. Even teleportation can escape dragon fire.
Okay. Maybe you're right about that.
Or maybe I'm wrong. So yeah. One of those two things.
Very likely you're wrong. Okay. John from Fairbanks, Alaska writes in, I'm writing to join into the discussion about the use of magic and its limits. I think there is a fundamental flaw in the ways most people are viewing what is called magic. I believe what we are dealing with instead is religion. Melisandre repeatedly says that she cannot simply perform magic at will. She's acting as a conduit for her god. She is from a monotheistic religion, coming into a land of polytheism, and trying to show her god as a dominant force. It's just like when Moses went into Egypt and showed the Egyptians the power of his god. Moses never claimed to be performing magic, even though his staff became a snake. He was simply the conduit for his god. At the heart of this was a struggle between religions. Even the proximity issue that comes up in the book you guys spoke about wasn't actually a proximity issue. In the book, Renly is in a castle that is said to be protected by old gods, and Davos has to sneak her inside the walls of the castle so that the barrier won't keep her smoke baby out. I think the stakes are that because Melisandre isn't really in control of the magic is what keeps her in check, her god chooses how to use the power. I could be completely wrong. It's just how I've always read the books. Thank you for your time. What do you think of John's email, Joanna?
I really liked that. I think I'm not saying John's 1000% correct, but I am saying that I don't think we've really brought the discussion of religion into it as much as we should have in terms of the monotheism and the polytheism of Davos versus Melisandre, how important that is and how in the book that they're currently covering the show, like it starts with this whole part on the island where Davos's devotion to Stannis is also tied into his religion and how frustrated he is that this woman has come in, this usurper has come in and burned all of his gods. And he believes that she has used her god's magic to entrap like his king. It's a religious struggle. And I don't think that I've brought that up enough. So I'm glad that John brought it up. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, and it's interesting. So I think the Moses comparison is really great, in particular that story, right? That the Egyptians were polytheistic and Moses was monotheistic, and kind of and showing what his god could do. The bit about Davos in the book, I'm sorry, the bit about the smoke baby in the book is interesting, that they had to go inside the castle walls because that's how they could invalidate the old god's power. In the show, really, we've only seen Melisandre's god demonstrate definitively that he has powers, right? Because I don't think we've seen any old gods do any magic yet in the show, or any old gods definitively show something. Am I right about this?
I don't know. Apparently they saved Jon Snow from death.
Yeah.
Even though Cat was back at word.
I guess. And then I'm not clear how the Bran magic stuff factors into the old gods, like whether that's going to be connected at all. But yeah, what's interesting is that thus far, the only gods we've seen without question actually have an effect are Melisandre's god, or is Melisandre's god. And so I think that's interesting that in the book, apparently, it sounds like it's a little bit more balanced between, like, the old gods are shown to actually have demonstrable power.
I wouldn't say that. What I would say is that I would say the red gods and the red god and like what Melisandre, that is definitely like a showier sort of power. I don't know. Like she doesn't get poisoned. I mean, I don't know. But what I liked was the idea that she's not ultimately in control, that she's just a conduit.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so it's like she can't just do whatever Stannis wants because she's acting as a messenger.
Right.
I don't know.
Right, and I mean that also kind of may explain that helps to explain any inconsistencies we might see towards how her magic is applied. So,
but I think the clash of religions and you know, Mance Rayder addresses it in this episode as well when he talks about all the different faiths that he's united under his rule up north. You know what I mean? All these different religions up there, that. As it would make sense, anytime you read a history of a war, you know, now wars are fought for oil and land and that sort of stuff. But historically, religion played such a bigger part. I mean, obviously, there are still religious wars. But, like, historically, religion played such a huge part in warfare that I think we shouldn't discount it.
Not even historically, necessarily.
No, I know. I mean, I of course, yes. Now that there are still religious wars, but I think you know, we also see a lot more of the other. I don't know. Anyway, I'm rambling, so I'll stop.
But Lauren from Shelby Township, Michigan, brought up an interesting point. She wrote in that she has not read the books, and the first thing that occurred to me when Barristan Selmy showed up was, does he know Jorah was an informant? The whole Jorah betraying Dany thing was brought up pretty conspicuously last season, and if he's fully committed to Dany now, wouldn't that make him want to rat out Jorah for being a lying liar who lies? Interesting point, Lauren. We'll see if that pans out. Obviously, Joanna cannot possibly comment on that. Right, Joanna?
Cricket sounds over here.
Okay, cool. And I think that is about it in terms of emails. A lot of great comments at slashfilm.com. A lot of debating over whether I'm an idiot or not, which is par for the course, I think.
Whether or not I like Lost or not. That
yeah,
seems to be
that's
important.
Right. Very passionate thoughts about Lost. So I think that's about it. Are there any other emails that you wanted to cover, Joanna?
Not this week, but I thank you guys so much. There were a ton of great emails, so keep them rolling. I think this is the best, you know, project that I've been a part of in terms of the caliber of emails that we get. So
yeah,
thank you guys.
Pretty, pretty amazing. And of course, I know a lot of people will have comments and corrections on what we've talked about this episode. So feel free to keep them coming to acastofkings@gmail.com. That's acastofkings@gmail.com. So that's going to bring us to the end of this week's episode of A Cast of Kings. Jonah Robinson, you want to tell people where they can find more of your work on the internet this week?
Every day on Pajiba.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at QuitYourJRob.
You can find me at Twitter.com/DaveChensky. That's Dave Chen, S-K-Y, and DaveChen.net. And find more of our episodes at GameOfThronesPodcast.com. Thank you guys for listening to A Cast of Kings, which is made possible by SlashFilm.com. We'll see you next week.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.